Are you ready?
To First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Happy Friday.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
You're a lying dog-faced pony soldier.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Crank that speaker.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. And you know what's going on right now? We've got Title IX being rewritten. Now, Title IX was created originally to allow women and girls an equal opportunity, especially when it comes to sports, in both public schools and in universities and colleges. And what's happening now? Joe Biden, without going to the Congress, is saying we're going to rewrite Title IX to say that it's whatever gender that you identify with, not necessarily your born gender, and that this is going to be forced on the states. And already we're hearing a number of states that are saying we're not going to do it. And so you're seeing a real split between the federal government and the governments of the states. So Ian Pryor joins me now, who's senior advisor with America First Legal. Ian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Is this the way that we're going to have to see this go down, that Joe Biden illegally or unconstitutionally rewrites a bunch of bureaucratic rules and then says we're going to force these on the states, and the state's only choice in this case, at least for the immediate future, is to simply say we're going to ignore the rules?
Well, that's certainly one way to do it. And the other way to do it is as we've done it, representing the state of Texas, suing the federal government for their vast overreach here in implementing this rule that changes the definition of sex way beyond what, you know, Congress could have contemplated in 1972 when they enacted Title IX. But this has really been something that's been on the horizon for years, ever since the Obama administration. You know, they tried to do this with a variety of guidance documents. Those guidance documents were either stopped by courts or they were revoked in the Trump administration. But you know, Biden is clearly looking to, you know, enact this insane regulatory agenda that, as you said, I mean, this is not something that is going to protect women. This is, you know, it is quackery. I mean, if there's one word to describe it, it's quackery. You know, biological sex is biological sex. It's ironic that the very same people that 4 years ago were telling everyone to follow the science are now putting rules in place telling you not to follow science.
Well, and in fact, if they thought this had the support of the American public, which is the way we're supposed to make rules and laws, I understand the need for a bureaucracy. I understand the need to write all the nitty-gritty rules that help implement a law. But if they thought this had the support of the American people, they'd march it up to Capitol Hill and say, let's vote on a bill. Let's change the definition of sex. But Joe Biden hasn't even tried to do that because apparently he knows that even Democrats on Capitol Hill are not going to pass such a bill. Doesn't he?
No, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. Any attempt to legislate this would be dead on arrival. So what they're trying to do with this rule is essentially rewrite legislation, which is not what the executive branch is supposed to do. The executive branch, you know, yes, they can implement rules that put into effect laws as they are written, but that is not what this does. This essentially overturns that law and now mandates that if you are a institution of higher learning or if you're K-12 elementary and you take any amount of federal funds whatsoever, then that means, you know, your girls' bathrooms now get to be opened up to, you know, boys based on their quote unquote gender identity, and they don't even really define what gender identity is. And that if you, you know, refer to somebody by he because, you know, the person is a male, you could be subject to discipline and discrimination proceedings because, you know, you misgendered them when they decide that they want to go by female pronouns. And that's really what this rule does. And it holds these schools and these educational institutions hostage because if you want federal funds, then you have to comply with this.
I mean, Ian, one of the things that's troubling, I'm not a lawyer or anything like that, and I always tell my audience that, but I thought, how can you get at this? If you're a young lady and you're going to either high school or college, and you're forced to use a locker room with a biological male who now identifies as female, your civil rights, your privacy rights, I think, are being violated. And they're creating a hostile environment for you. I haven't heard any stories yet that indicate that some young lady said, look, I was on the tennis team, but I'm not showering with guys, so I'm going to have to quit the team. This is unconscionable. Is there any action that individuals like parents and grandparents could take to say, well, then let's file a civil rights violation? If your school is forcing you to shower with or use a bathroom with a biological male, they're creating a hostile hostile environment. Now, would hostile environment still apply there, even though it's not a workplace?
Well, you know, we actually have a case in Virginia against Fairfax County Public Schools on this issue. It's in state court. It's not in federal court. So we're proceeding under the Virginia Constitution. And, you know, there's two theories to this case. I mean, it involves a young woman at school that didn't feel comfortable using a bathroom in which a biological boy based on some kind of gender identity was using it. And when, you know, she asked the principal, she was said, well, you know, if you want to feel safe and comfortable in the bathroom, you're going to have to use the single use bathroom. Well, look, that is sex discrimination.
Yes, it is.
It is plain and simple. So you're telling me that a biological male gets to feel safe and comfortable in the bathroom of the sex that they quote unquote identify with, but the biological female doesn't have that same option in the bathroom of her actual biological sex? That is discrimination against a female. It is sex discrimination. And we also have in there, you know, it's religious discrimination. You know, it's something that violates her rights of conscience. And then on the pronoun piece, that's another claim that we have in there where, in Virginia recently, the Virginia Supreme Court said, look, it is against the Virginia Constitution to require somebody to speak a certain way, especially on these most, you know, controversial topics that are not settled. And we had a similar decision from the Supreme Court last year, the United States Supreme Court, not on this exact issue, but it's clear that you cannot compel speech.
Well, in fact, Ian, I had to explain back when Obama tried to push this through the letter of guidance, you know, from the Department of Ed, and they specifically said, because I read the letter, you can't just give the trans kids a separate bathroom to use. That is not acceptable. And they made it clear. You can't get away with it by just sending the trans kids. Well, if you can't send the trans kids and say use the single-use bathroom, you can't do it to the girls or the boys either. And I mean, they're really creating this fight where there doesn't need to be a fight. If boys want to take part in athletics, they should take part in any kind of boys' athletics they want. But they're not allowed to compete against girls. And this is throwing girls under the bus. It's saying you can go ahead and compete, but the boys are going to be faster and stronger and in many cases more capable, and you're going to get knocked out of the competition. Ian, thanks for what you're doing at America First Legal, and I appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Ian Pryor, a senior advisor with America First Legal. Your emails are always welcome, talk@LarsLarson.com. If you want to check out our Instagram feed, you'll find that at the Lars Larson Show on Instagram. If you want to tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show, that's always fun. And, of course, you can always call the show, 866-439-5277.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Warning to Hamas at the Republican Jewish Coalition Conference.
If you spill a drop of American blood, we will spill a gallon of yours.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And yeah, I'll talk about Joe Biden and his agreeing to debate Donald Trump, something I think he kind of surprised his own campaign with. We'll get to that a little bit later. I have to tell you something that really gets under my skin. Politicians who will tell you in Oregon and Washington all day long, oh, we have to protect farming. In fact, they use it as a regular excuse to cram as many people as they can in both states into a tiny piece of land in the big cities. And they'll tell you why we can't build on land in Oregon or Washington because we're practically running out of it. Let's look at the real numbers. Less than 4% of the state of Oregon or state of Washington is occupied by human beings, their houses, their industries, and everything else. The rest of the states are empty. And it took us roughly 150 years to get to the point where we cover less than 4% of the state. If we allowed that to increase, say, by 50% in the next, say, 50 or 100 years, we'd be occupying 6% of the state, or less than 6% of the state. So when I see the news that the excuse they often use is, say, the reason we have to cram people into big cities and make people live cheek to jowl in Seattle or Portland or anywhere else is we have to preserve farmland. And yet farms, as Senator Ron Mazzal points out, are simply disappearing. Senator, welcome back to the program. Thanks for the work you do representing the Whidbey Island area.
Thank you, Lars. Pleasure to be here.
Why are the farms disappearing so quickly?
Well, largely it's economics, but those economics are perpetuated by legislative actions. We can look at a long series of legislative actions that just make the economics of agriculture almost impossible in the state of Washington.
So we have a state that says we want to protect agriculture. Oregon runs the same kind of line of reasoning, which they then contradict. And then the state comes along and says you have to pay overtime after 40 years to farm workers, which made the farmers lose workers and the workers lose money at the end of the day, right? Is that an example of what you're talking about when you say legislation is putting the farms out of business?
Oh, yeah, that's just one of them. The Carbon Commitment Act, which wasn't supposed to impact agriculture, but did. The overtime laws, the minimum wage itself. We have to compete with states like Idaho and Montana and Utah that don't have the same level of costs that we have. And that's why we're seeing producers just giving it up. And then just the general economics of agriculture. The really frustrating thing to me, Lars, is the fact that there are legislators that pick and choose. Oh, you know, we love the small-scale agriculture. And you know, on 5 acres, well, we call those five-year wonders because after 5 years, they wonder what the heck they're doing, and they go get a real job. But they don't like scaled agriculture, which produces food that the general population can afford to buy. They don't like them. They want everybody to go to the farmer's market, which I have no problem at all with. But the reality is not everybody can afford to or has availability to go to a farmer's market.
Yeah, it's not close by and it's not affordable because, I mean, people can disparage mass production of food, but then when you tell them what it's going to cost to buy food that is produced not in a mass production way, they're either stunned by the cost or they tell you, I can't afford to feed my family.
That's exactly right. We need the full scale of agriculture from commodity producers to local small producers. We need them all. But our legislature likes to believe that, oh, one part is bad, one part is good, and we need to separate that out, and we could care less about large-scale agriculture. But that's what feeds. I mean, 20% of producers produce 80% of the products. I mean, that's just the fact of life. And if we take the 80% that produce 20%, we can't survive off of that. Our stores' shelves will be empty.
And by the way, the number in this piece you wrote an op-ed for the Seattle Times Fish Wrapper, and you said 14 farms a week on average are going out of business and going away?
Well, here's an example. In the next couple of weeks, Toppenish Livestock, which is probably our biggest livestock auction yard, is going to have three dairy sales. One 400 cows, one 2,000 cows of 350 bred heifers, another 1,000 cow dairy with 1,000 heifers. So they're getting out. These are large dairies who are just getting out completely. We've seen this continue on and on and on, and who really cares? It was Pam Lewison who wrote the editorial, and does anybody really care? And I have said, you know, well, the last farmer out of Washington, please close the barnyard gate. This going back to the 60s, you know, please turn off the lights.
And Boeing, yeah.
Yeah, but the reality is that I don't talk to anybody, and I've been around, I'm ranking member on the Senate Ag Committee. Over the last 2 years, I've been around and talked to the Beef Commission, the Dairy Commission, the fruit, the hop, the berry, all of these. Nobody is optimistic about the future. And really and truthfully, we've got the fifth generation back on our farm. I wonder what their future is going to be if we continue this push to electrify everything. We rely on a lot of electricity, but as that cost ratchets up, can we economically make it? We can't find help, and when we do find them, it is so expensive, we have to question that. I mean, price of fuel, oh, yeah, you don't have to pay it. Oh, yeah, you're going to pay it. Oh, it's somebody else's fault. Well, these costs continue escalating to the point in time there's nothing left. You know, it's simple math, but for some reason, the legislature doesn't understand that.
No, and it's funny because, Senator, last weekend, Tina and I went out to a nursery that we like. It's a small nursery, as run by a lady and her family, to buy some plants to put in our yard. And I noticed as I was walking by, there was a propane tank there, because if you want to get plants started early in the spring, you're gonna heat those greenhouses a little bit until the sun does the job. And I'm sure those farmers are saying, I'm going to use as little propane as I possibly can. But now with Jay Inslee's climate commitment tax, the carbon tax, I'm sure that price has gone up. And what's that greenhouse supposed to do? And this is a small operation, by the way. When the state comes by and says, hey, we'd like you to convert your greenhouses to electricity. Can you imagine heating a plastic sheeting greenhouses with electricity instead of propane or natural gas or something like that? Senator Mazzal, thanks very much. I appreciate the time. That's Washington State Senator Ron Mazzal, who points out farms are disappearing. And I would point out to you the tie-in to everybody in the city, whether you care about farming or not, and there are people who apparently don't care as long as there's food on their table, it affects you too. Because when they tell you, why, we can't allow you to build houses on that land, we're saving it for the farmers, and then they tell the farmers, we're going to put you out of business and you won't be a farmer anymore, then what are we saving the land for? It sounds like we're saving it so the elites in Seattle and Portland have a nice view as they drive from point A to point B. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Some solid advice from Senator John Kennedy.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's become something I've expected to see almost every single week. A brand new horrendous crime committed again by illegal aliens allowed in just in the last 3 years by Joseph R. Biden. Over on open borders, and I've been trying to persuade people this is going to create not just today, but it's going to create an ongoing issue of crimes against Americans, sometimes rape, sometimes murder, and we can cite specific examples of that. And many of the examples you probably will never hear about, because much of the legacy media will do stories about somebody who's suffered a rape, been the victim of a rape, or been the victim of a murder. And the story will not at all mention, if they can possibly avoid it, the fact that the suspect or the person accused is in fact in the country illegally, because that would run counter to certain other political goals that much of the media has. So I wanted to talk to Jonathan E. Mord, who's a constitutional law attorney and the author most recently of The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from 19th Century to Present. Jonathan, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Lars.
How much are we going to be able to, how much do you think Americans are going to tolerate before they absolutely demand change of this open border? And let me cite one more data point, and that is just in the last 2 days, we've seen a brand new Harris poll, which I think is, I look at the reputation of the pollsters as we get them, and there's some that I think, oh, they tilt to the left, tilt to the right, or they're mostly down the middle. Harris says that a majority of Americans, 51%, favor mass deportation of illegals, and that includes 46% of Democrats. Have we finally reached the breaking point for Americans where they've seen what 3.5 years of an open border will do to the country?
Yes, I think so. I think people are fed up with this planned destruction of the United States, and that's exactly what this is. They're not only opening the border and letting anyone come into this country, including enemies of the United States, agents of those enemies, drug traffickers, sex traffickers, MS-13, 18th Street gang members, and terrorists, but they're also incentivizing their entry by giving them welfare, food stamps, cash, free cell phones at our expense, and tickets to go wherever they want, paid by NGOs that are 100% taxpayer funded. So this is a disgrace. It is a planned ruination of our country, and people are fed up with it. We probably have some 20 to 30 million illegal aliens in this country who form a massive underground economy. They can't work legally, and so they work illegally with below minimum wages. They are taking away jobs from legal immigrants, and they're taking away jobs from American citizens. And at the same time, we have this massive criminal enterprise that the cartels are supporting inside the United States, drug trafficking and sex trafficking. I represent two families whose daughters were sex trafficked within the Fairfax County public school system. One was 12 years old in Herndon Middle School. And she was, and that's a case, again, of an illegal alien boy who is in the MS-13 gang, and he seduced this girl. He's in the school with himself, and she was sex trafficked for over a year, and right through the school system. And this is the threat, and this is the danger, and it's absolutely real, and it's becoming ubiquitous. And I think all people right. have had it.
Do you think, though, that the folks, I mean, on the president's side, on Biden's side, are looking at this and realizing we have to change? And I'd cite, there was a letter sent by five Democrats either this week or last week demanding that the president, and these are Democrats asking Joe Biden to put Title 42 back in place, and that he start enforcing federal law, and that the expulsion authority that CBP had until it expired last year be renewed. Is this a sign that even the left-wingers on the Democrat side of the aisle are saying this is too much, and we're going to lose the American people over this?
Well, the left-wingers who are in control of this administration, who really have our whole nation being held hostage, have no interest whatsoever in ending this. It's part of a greater globalist objective, which is to basically destroy the security that we have so that we will accept government control. You know, it's a sad reality, but if you put all the pieces together, there's no question but that this is an intended destruction. This isn't something that's incidental or mistaken. They actually do understand fully what's happening, and they do not care one whit about the effects on the American citizen, except, as Rahm Emanuel said during the Biden or the Obama years, you never let a crisis go to waste. Well, in those days, they used to wait for a crisis. Well, now they create the crisis, and
well,
they're taking full advantage of it.
Jonathan, what's the end game? In other words, I understand the Democrats could say, why, this is going to be a new dependent class of residents, not citizens. We will be able to make it possible for them to vote, and there appears to be very much a plan to do that. And that federal law, to some extent, allows them to do it. Arizona has said you can't register to vote in a state election, but we will let you register to vote under the motor voter to vote in federal elections. Well, that's what most of the national DNC wants, is they want the votes from the national election. And Arizona demands its own residents prove citizenship to vote. But they're saying if you just want to vote for Joe and a Democrat for the U.S. Senate, we'll let you do that. And we'll make it happen.
Yes, it very definitely has an effect, is in their interest to try to break down the integrity of the election process so that illegals can vote, and they certainly are trying to do that. But the bigger picture, really, is that they don't care at all what happens to the American citizen. They don't care if your life is taken. In these instances, like this poor child that was raped by this Honduran illegal immigrant who was released by Steve Descano, who is a Soros-backed prosecutor in Fairfax County, he won't prosecute any sex trafficking cases. He doesn't do it.
Why?
And so
what does he use as an excuse? How does he excuse that?
Well, they like to think that the perpetrators of the crime are victims, and that somehow we owe it to them to not incarcerate them when they commit heinous acts. But the reality is they've really bought into the Soros agenda. George Soros has his hands in virtually every aspect of this.
Yep.
He wants the open borders. He wants to defund the police. He finances it. He wants rioting in the streets. He supports BLM and Antifa. He even supports the Muslim Brotherhood in America. And this is a man who wants to see the United States brought down so that a totalitarian global regime can be brought up. And he wants the United States, as he said many years ago in his books, he said that the United States is an obstacle to this totalitarian regime, and he identified why it was. American nationalism, American love of its constitution and rights. So when you dilute the population with individuals who are even here illegally, you reduce the power of the electorate and those who came, legal immigrants, right, once lawfully entered the country. And the whole purpose of that, in the end, is to disenfranchise, essentially, the Americans who are interested in defending their rights and defending this Constitution and ensuring the survival and success of our country along its traditional lines. And so this is what it's about. To use Schumer's language, this is transformational change.
Wow. Mr. Emord, it's a pleasure to have you on. That's Jonathan Emord, who's a constitutional law attorney and the author most recently of The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to Present. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And, of course, naysayers go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. Another strong take from President Biden on AI and the weather.
Helping Webb telescope. My God, what is this?
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. To your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Linda, welcome to the program on First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. I was listening to your guest in the last segment, and you said that 70% of people do not have the choice to go to college. When did the choice get taken away?
I thought I said opportunity.
Okay.
Now, okay.
Other question is, okay, that clarifies that.
Okay.
And perhaps if we made education less expensive, they might have the opportunity. But my
question is, does 70%
of people who didn't go to college, do they not need the people who get degrees to be nurses and doctors and teachers? Do they not need their services?
Well, Linda, you're asking a question that twists in the middle, and let me tell you why. Yes, we need engineers, doctors, we don't mean very many lawyers, but engineers, doctors, nurses, people like that. But colleges don't only produce those. They produce a lot of other things like the diverse underwater basket weaving degrees that are worth almost nothing in the private marketplace. So I've asked economists over the years when I've had them on talking about jobs in America, I've said, what percentage of jobs in a technological country like America, we're not Uganda, we're not Kenya, we're a very advanced country, but what percentage of jobs would benefit from people who have a four-year degree? And their answer uniformly across all the economists I've taught and job experts is 25 to 30%. Now, politicians love to run around saying every American kid should go to college. That is stupid. It really is. I have to call it, and I don't call a lot of things stupid, but that's stupid because do you need to have that level of skill or training to do the jobs? And the answer is no. In fact, an awful lot of the kids who go to college would be better off if they said, I'm not going to do a four-year degree. I might need 2 years of training in accounting. I might need two years of training in a lot of other things, but not a four-year degree. But we've popularized the idea that everybody should go to college. The economy can't make use of you.
Okay, I understand. But the other thing that I'm thinking of is, okay, so you said, okay, if you want to be a social worker, and God knows we need social workers. We got people running around killing each other and everything's crazy. You might not be able to be that because you can't pay the loan back. So what kind of sense does that make?
No, the marketplace
will
figure.
We don't need social workers?
No, hold on. I would say that an awful lot of social worker jobs are not tremendously useful. Let me use your example. You say we have a lot of crazy people running around. Probably, arguably, a greater percentage of the population is living on the streets as homeless, drug addicted, mentally ill, etc. So we have more of them than ever before. Do we also have more social workers today than America has ever had before?
I don't know the answer to that.
Well, Linda, I don't have a date for when America invented the job of social worker. I mean, there's certainly been people who've worked for the poor and the down and out for hundreds of years in this country, but most of them didn't call themselves social workers. They were your local priest or pastor, reverend. There were people who worked with people to help them out. But we've created a whole category called social worker, and I'm suggesting we have more social workers than America has ever had before, and we have more people with problems than we've ever had before. Does that suggest that the prevalence of social workers is not addressing the problem?
Yeah, that could be. But would you agree that if we cut down the price, how much it costs
yes.
to supplement and college,
yes.
the better,
yes.
more people.
But can I tell you how you cut the price?
Need to be nurses,
do you know
doctors,
how, Linda,
psychiatrists, psychologists.
Okay, thank you, thank you. Do you know how you cut the price of something? You do not.
How do you do that?
You don't subsidize it. You do not subsidize. And that is what we've done with college. We've said, we'll give you an easy loan. We will give subsidies. We'll give hundreds of millions of dollars to colleges. Let me give you a model that works. Do you have a cell phone?
Sure.
Do you know how much we've paid? Before the Obama phone came along, do you know how much the government subsidized cell phones? Zero.
No.
Zero. Now, I saw the first cell phones in 1985 that came to my town, and the bag phone was $1,800, and a brick phone like Gordon Gekko had was $3,500. I go to Walmart tonight and buy a plain vanilla cell phone, even a smartphone, for about $30. Do you know why the price came down and the quality went up over the last 40 years? Because it wasn't subsidized. And I'll give you a second one from medicine. Laser surgery, LASIK eye surgery, is almost no insurance plan pays for it, and it's not subsidized. Do you know what's happened? You go back 20, 30 years, it costs tens of thousands of dollars per eye to get it done. Today, it is done very, very well, and it's done very, very inexpensively. If you want to get the price of something down, get the government subsidies out of it. Linda, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. I'm not afraid of social media. Check us out on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and all the other social media, and tell Alexa to play The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson.
Are you ready?
To First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Happy Friday.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
You're a lying dog-faced pony soldier.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Crank that speaker.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I always look forward to visiting with our friend John Solomon. John founded JustTheNews.com. He's one of the best investigative journalists in America, bar none, and he's going to prove it tonight by telling us the evidence he's got. No, you are. I'm selling this to her. John, don't laugh when I'm selling you. That John is going to prove this. The Biden administration's incentive to go after Donald Trump's fake document case was actually to take pressure off because they knew the Joe Biden classified documents issue was coming. So they said, okay, we'll just accuse Donald Trump of doing the thing that we know our boss is soon going to be accused of doing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Listen, timelines are an important way that journalists piece news together and piece complicated stories together. And what we now know from the court system because of unsealed documents in the classified documents case against Donald Trump, Judge Eileen Cannon released these, now unredacted. It was only a few weeks after Joe Biden, they discovered, uh-oh, we've got a problem. Joe Biden kept some very sensitive documents at the UPenn Biden Center. They discovered that in March 2021, just a few weeks into the Biden presidency. All of a sudden, the conversation starts tilting towards the National Archives, the Justice Department, and the Biden White House Counsel's Office. What are we going to do about Donald Trump? Let's put pressure on him. Let's build a criminal referral against him. It's really remarkable for two reasons. One, the timetable is so obvious now that Joe Biden has a problem first, and then he tries to create a problem for Donald Trump. But as the process starts to build on, you get to fall of 2021. You see the National Archives and their lawyer, the one who's working with the White House, trying to draft a criminal referral. And some of the people around him saying, hey, we don't do this. We don't do criminal referrals against presidents. We don't get the Justice Department involved. We try to negotiate and solve these issues, but clearly the Biden White House and its allies in the National Archives and the Justice Department wanted to go a different route. They wanted to escalate against Donald Trump. That timetable is now eminently clear, and there's one very big question that no one seems to be able to answer. Why is it that the Biden White House counsel was involved in a matter involving the Trump ex-presidency? That's not a place for the Biden White House counsel to be. It's not their business. It's a prior president in the archives. The Biden White House counsel's insinuation into this matter, first in looking at the referral, then encouraging it to go to the FBI, and then piercing Donald Trump's claims of executive privilege, puts Joe Biden directly in the line of trying to create a criminal case against his chief political rival.
Well, and ordinarily, you've been covering presidential administrations a long time. Don't presidents at least go to considerable effort to make sure that they can say, I appointed the attorney general, but they operate independently from the president. The president doesn't pick up the phone and call Merrick Garland. In theory, he doesn't, and say, by the way, you need to do this or you need to do that. They usually try to make sure there's some distance between the two, even though Merrick Garland clearly knows who he works for.
Yeah, and listen, I think the White House counsel's insinuation in this case takes away some of that plausible deniability, some of that distance. The White House counsel's office works directly for the president, President Biden's chief lawyer in government. And the fact that they're playing with NARA, they're playing with the Justice Department, they're suggesting that a referral be sent to the FBI, it really does put Joe Biden's finger directly in the drink in the form of his own staff meddling in this matter and against historical precedent, too. That's the second part of this, right? First, all right, you've got the lack of separation between Biden and the Justice Department.
But there's not a precedent for this. Many presidents have had long-running disputes with the archives. Bill Clinton had a dispute that went on for 10 years involving some tapes he had in a sock drawer. That didn't get resolved until 2013. Bill Clinton left office in 2001. We didn't prosecute Bill Clinton, but within a few short months, Joe Biden's team is moving towards a criminal prosecution of Donald Trump. It really sort of captures the essence of what Alan Dershowitz wrote in his book, which is get Trump. There's a mentality to get Trump that exceeds all prior precedents and also the normal course of staying out of it, chief political rivals staying out of their the matters of their enemies. It didn't happen here. There was no separation, and I think that's what disturbs so many people right now.
Well, John, let me add one more thing to that, if you think it fits. Who's Alvin Bragg's chief counsel, the guy who's or co-counsel on the current yes. criminal prosecution in New York? Who is that man?
Yeah. He's a man named Colangelo who worked in the Biden Justice Department. Then he went over to Letitia James, and then he went over to Alvin Bragg. Yeah. He's on the three hops of the three prosecution offices that have gone after Donald Trump.
Well, and not only that, John, but help me put this in context. So you've got a guy working in the U.S. Justice Department, which is probably, you know, it's nice to put on your resume, but it's not sure. the biggest moneymaker in the world
nope.
because most of the people who do that level of law could go to work in private industry and double or triple or quadruple or more
right.
their salaries. This guy left the DOJ to work for the Manhattan DA's office. Is that not a step down and a pay cut?
It certainly is an unusual move. It's a political move, not a career advancement move. And I think that's one of the many things that jumps out at people who analyze this. And I think there's this whole mentality. There's a whole cottage industry that was built around the idea that we're going to get Donald Trump at all costs. It began in 16 with Russia collusion and all of those, the MI5 agent, Christopher Steele, and the Apple researchers that were working for Hillary Clinton. And then it spun off into Ukraine impeachment, and then it spins off into January 6th, and now it spins off into let's have as many prosecutions of Donald Trump as we can muster in 2024. And, of course, they all hit in 2024, just the way the Democrats set it up. It really smacks of something that we don't do in America. We don't use our legal system to settle political scores. We let elections do that. But in this case, the Joe Biden Democratic Party seems to have breached that decorum, that breached that rule that we've had for that's kept us sane for the last 247 years of our constitutional republic.
But John, is there any way to call people to account for this?
It's a great question, right? I think the first accounting is the jury of the American electorate. What yeah. decisions they make on November 5th will start that process. In between now and then, the Supreme Court and the decisions that immunity were being debated today, you saw justices very concerned about the precedent. Yeah. Very, very concerned. And we're opening up a banana republic possibility here.
We're going to hit the break in about a minute. But, John, especially when one of the justices says, well, if you can prosecute Trump for whatever yeah. they claim he did on January the 6th, give a speech and be blamed for an insurrection that was never charged as an insurrection. How about Barack Obama dropping missiles on a whole bunch of people? And could he be prosecuted under the federal murder statute? That was a question that came from a justice of the Supreme Court.
It did, and it does show the dual system of justice that Trump's prosecution creates automatically, just looking backwards. And then you look into the future, and you wonder, boy, if this continues, every president will want, as Justice Alito said, no president will want to give up power because they're going to be afraid their rival's going to indict him as soon as they leave. Very profound debate that went on today in the Supreme Court.
You can find the story, and it's a great one, from John Solomon at justthenews.com. John, thank you very much. Glad to get your emails. Send those to talk@LarsLarson.com. And check me out on Instagram. We got some special stuff there as well.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Upcoming American elections promise some provocative politics, but be forewarned, the green agenda may lead to some extreme rhetoric.
Die, gas pumper!
So prepare yourself by listening to The Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you and a real pleasure to welcome back to the show from the great state of Tennessee, Senator Marsha Blackburn. Senator, thanks for coming on.
Delighted to join you. Thank you.
I was delighted today when I saw that there are at least a couple of sensible states. I don't know that Tennessee has done this yet, but they've said, yeah, you want to give us those new Title IX changes that the Biden administration wants put through without going to the Congress that will work against actual biological females, but in favor of trans. And they said, go ahead and pass them. We're not going to follow them. I mean, what should we make of the fact that Joe Biden has told the schools through this Title IX letter that's being sent out by President Biden and Secretary of Ed Miguel Cardona that they want all these changes so that all of this will be based on gender identity?
And their goal is to make it all about gender identity. What you'll end up with are boys' teams and teams of people who identify as female, but not necessarily a female team. I've got to tell you, Lars, I have talked to so many women. Many of them have children. And, of course, they're furious about this because Title IX is something that has preserved opportunity for girls in the sports arena. And now to say, look, biological males can compete against biological females if the biological male says they choose to identify as a female. So it's a dangerous, slippery slope, and it's something that really yanks the rug out from under women's sports.
And in almost all cases, the biological male is going to perform at a level superior to that of the biological girls that he's actually pretending to be.
Of course, and they are bigger, stronger, faster, and we know that. And that is why you have men's categories and women's categories in these sporting events. The other thing, too, what we have seen from some of the school districts that allow this, girls are getting hurt, whether it is soccer or basketball or any of the other sports.
Even volleyball, Senator. Even volleyball.
Yeah,
imagine
volleyball.
Imagine right. A 6'4", 200-pound male slamming a volleyball back across the net. There have been some young ladies badly hurt by getting hit in the face with a ball that's not hit by another girl but hit by a biological male.
That's right. And the personal safety issue, the security issue of these girls, when you hear about the locker rooms and the fact that the males come in and they're changing in those same locker rooms and girls being exposed in a manner that they would choose not to have to be exposed. So I think this is a situation where the American people are looking at this president and saying, you are totally, completely out of line.
Let me ask you this, though. You've joined with three other senators in this letter. Do we have every Republican on board? And do we not have a single Democrat who will get on board a sensible point of view, which is this change to Title IX is wrong?
And so far, we have no further Democrats that are on or none that have expressed interest. We have, we'll see what happens tomorrow. I expect we'll have a few more Republicans get on.
How is it possible? But Senator, I'm really disappointed with the Republican Party lately, and especially a lot of things that have happened in the House of Representatives. And I know you're over in the other chamber, the upper chamber, but it floors me that you don't automatically have, you know, 49 Republicans all on board saying you can't do this to young ladies. Why do you suppose it is that so many of your fellow Republicans won't do that?
I don't know why they've chosen not to come on board the letter. I never speak for another colleague. I do know this is one of the top issues with the American people is the disgust that they express by seeing men trying to compete against women in women's sports. They want the women to have their own categories of competition, and they don't want to have men competing in those divisions.
Let me ask you about the other concern you've raised, because this one is going to go right to people's front doors, and that is you and other senators have said Uber Eats, DoorDash, Grubhub, and other of the delivery services are starting to use some of these illegal aliens that Joe Biden has allowed to invade our country. Can you describe how that's happening? Because they have no right to work in this country.
They have no right to work. They don't have a work permit. But, Lars, as we all know, the cartels charge everyone who's coming in the country. They all pay a fee to the cartel. You don't come in without first paying the cartel. So in order for these people to work, and of course some work as drug runners, some go out and do smash and grabs as part of gangs, MS-13 gangs, El Salvador gangs, Trandiagua, the Venezuelan gang. So they get placed with a gang and they're earning their money that way, paying the cartel the majority of what they make. So now what they're doing is utilizing apps that people that deliver food for Uber Eats and DoorDash, things of that nature, they absolutely are coming in and giving them permission to work on their app. So these individuals that are not vetted are working on somebody else's app and employee number, and they're running around, they're delivering food, they're getting these tips, and people are opening their door to strangers who are not vetted. They don't know their intent, why they're in the country, and all of a sudden now you have a group of people out here delivering food who are not vetted, and we don't know if the name they're giving and using is even their real name.
Well, tell me this. Do you think that those companies could fairly readily screen out the people and say, you can't work for us if you can't prove that you're in the country legally, the same way every employer, including me, has to have employees sign an I-9 and prove that they're legal?
When you've got somebody that is piggybacking your app, or you've given them permission to piggyback and use your name and employee number, then it looks like everything is fine to Grubhub or someone like that. But we do know for a fact this activity of borrowing somebody's employee number and their app is taking place.
Well, the fact is we ought to tell them if you get caught doing it, you ought to be fired. That's Marsha Blackburn, senator from the great state of Tennessee. Senator, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Back in a moment, I'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you've got the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.
Portland.
Constantine Kissin on Hamas.
For years now, many of us have been warning that the barbarians are at the gates. We were wrong. They're inside. There are positives as well. I mean, say what you want about Hamas supporters. At least they know what a woman is.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a bit. It's a great pleasure to welcome back to the show Gary Sinise, who's been kind enough to do what he does for American veterans and, of course, an annual Memorial Day concert, and nice enough to spend a few minutes with us. The pride of Blue Island, Illinois, Gary Sinise, otherwise known as Lieutenant Dan. Mr. Sinise, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I guess Blue Island doesn't get mentioned that often, probably not as often as Forrest Gump, but would you mind sharing with my audience? I want them to know why, year after year after year, you give your own time and effort and money to some extent to these concerts to pay tribute to the people who've given their lives in service to this great country.
Well, Lars, I've I just have a lot of veterans in my family, and it starts there. I mean, there are so many veterans in my family. Really, it goes back a long way. You know, it was really my wife's brothers who I started talking to who really opened my eyes and made me think a lot. And so I wanted to do something to help our Vietnam veterans out. I got very actively involved in the 80s doing that in Chicago. And then along comes the opportunity to audition for Forrest Gump and to play a Vietnam veteran. And that started a whole new chapter. I actually, because he was a wounded veteran, I got involved with the DAV, the Disabled American Veterans Organization. So that goes back 30 years.
I agree with you. And frankly, I've got the same connection or lack of a connection. I've never served in uniform, but my father and mother both did. But they were the World War II generation, and they came home, I think, to a hero's welcome. Vietnam, you're right. I was still in high school when a lot of the Vietnam veterans were coming home, and they weren't treated well at all. And now I kind of wonder when I look around and see so many veterans living on the streets, not getting adequate care from the VA. I think the VA has failed them to a large extent. I want to make sure we don't see this happen again. When you go out and put on a uniform and serve your country, you deserve to come home honored for your service and not disregarded.
Well, and that's where the Gary Sinise Foundation came from. And I started, I started with the USO back in like over 20 years ago, and I started supporting various military nonprofits. And 10 or 11 years later, I started my own, which is the Gary Sinise Foundation. Now we've raised a lot of money and deployed it all over so that we do our best to fill any cracks that might be left. We don't want people falling through the cracks. You know, we can take some responsibility if we have resources, and I have resources as somebody who's in the public, has a public platform, and I can try to deploy those resources to help people out.
I'm talking to Gary Sinise that you know well from his role as Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump, of course, but also the Gary Sinise Foundation. I want you to tell my audience what's going to be contained in this year's concert so they can participate vicariously and perhaps be inspired to help out the foundation.
Oh gosh! Every year, it's the producers do a magnificent job. Michael Colbert and Paul Miller, the director. I mean, they do a tremendous job. They have a great story too, because both Michael's dad Jerry and Paul's dad Walter, you know, they were involved in this concert from the beginning. They have both passed away, and their sons Michael and Paul have assumed the mantle and kept the show going in the spirit of what, you know, what Jerry and Walter kind of defined as, you know, the way the Memorial Day concert should be set up. So each year it's wonderful. And they have a great host of performers this year, Bryan Cranston. They have Gary LaVox. Jenna Malone is on. Cynthia Erivo is performing. Jamie Johnson, Mary McCormick is back again. Mary comes each year. She's been coming a lot. And, you know, I've been doing it with Joe Mantegna now, co-hosting since 2006. The National Symphony Orchestra with Jack Everly. We have, of course, a big focus on our World War II generation. Bryan Cranston will be telling a personal story of a World War II veteran story. We have a Gold Star Family segment, of course. We have a wonderful story about an Afghanistan veteran who lost a leg. Kirsty Ennis lost a leg in a helicopter crash, but she's just like a powerhouse and a really inspirational person. So a lot of great stories we'll be celebrating. And, of course, we remember the fallen. That's always a special moment when Taps is played and the audience stands up and very quiet and somber.
Mr. Sinise, I'd be remiss, I think, if I didn't mention that your own family has gone through some tragedy this year, not related to military service, but the death of your son. And if you wanted to say a word about Max Sinise.
Well, Thanks, Lars. Our son, Mac, is named after my wife's older brother, who was a two-tour Vietnam veteran, West Point graduate in the class of 66. Mac, my wife's brother, actually died of cancer himself back in 1983. And our son, you know, he kind of grew up around me doing movies and then going off and doing all this stuff for the troops. And he got caught up in it. And in 2017, he came to work for the Gary Sinise Foundation. 2018, we found out that he had a very serious incurable cancer called chordoma. And it's, you know, it was very tough. And he fought it for 5.5 years, and it disabled him. He was a musician and composer. And I wrote a story that's on the homepage at GarySiniseFoundation.org that kind of tells the story. And it's, you know, while there's certainly sadness in the story about what happened to Mac, there's also kind of inspiration as well, because he was a musician and composer. And because of the cancer disabling him, he had to put that down and just fight cancer for the longest time. But the last year of his life, he picked up music again and went into the studio and recorded some music, even with his disability. And he was a drummer. He couldn't drum anymore because he was in a wheelchair, but he picked up harmonica. And he went in the studio and he performed the song on harmonica called Shenandoah, that great American classic. That's on his YouTube channel, Mac Sinise YouTube. But he recorded an entire album with his friend Oliver Schnee. They teamed up, recorded an entire album. It's called Resurrection and Revival. And that's really the hopeful thing here is that Mac was satisfied and happy at the end of his life. He had achieved what he wanted to with his music. And I knew that he was, you know, he was at peace. You can read about it on the Gary Sinise Foundation website. And the album has actually sold over 3,000 copies, and Mac wanted all the proceeds to go to the Gary Sinise Foundation.
Wow. Mr. Sinise, thank you so much, and thanks for allowing me the latitude to ask you about the passing of McKenna Anthony Sinise, Mac Sinise, earlier this year. And God bless you for what you do for those who've given their lives in service to this country, and I appreciate the time, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Lars. Thank you.
That is Gary Sinise, very much behind the Memorial Day concert that is in honor of those who've given their lives in the service to our country. And we have to remember all the veterans, those who come home having made the ultimate sacrifice, and those who come home wounded or otherwise compromised by their service to this great country. We'll be back in just a moment, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio North.
Reagan knew better. Do you?
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
If you want to have a federal law against no-compete agreements, those are agreements where you go to work for somebody and the worker agrees and the employer agrees that if you decide to leave at the end of your agreement, there's a period of time when you can't compete. I've seen it applied in my business. I'm under a no-compete. I don't have a problem with them. And yet here's the Biden administration saying we are going to ban these kind of agreements. And they're going to do that through the Federal Trade Commission and not the Congress, which is problematic in and of itself. But if you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And naysayers always go first. So, Kevin, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening on KIDO. So, Kevin, you're in favor of this ban on no-competes. Is that right?
Yeah, I work in the entertainment tech part, and it's kind of funny you did this because I just got, they just completely eliminated my division in this company, even though we were making the company more than what we cost them. And I've got to sit out for 6 months before I can get a job in this market. You know, I've got a home, I own a home here. And that's my problem with the non-competes is that if they decide to let you go, you're stuck for that time, and I only have a 30-day pay. You know, they're going to pay me for 30 days, but after that, the next 5 months of, you know, unemployment here. So, yeah, I'm all for getting rid of these just because it makes the – it really also will take that employer and make them appreciate that employee just that much more, which I've seen a lot of that, too, where the employer takes advantage of the employee because, hey, they've got a non-compete.
What's your no-compete for?
6 months.
6 months. So you have to go do something else or do it somewhere else for you to get a job, and you agreed to it. That's the strange part, is right, that you say, I didn't want to have this agreement. So, I mean, you could go to work for an employer and say, we don't have paid vacation. Now, there aren't too many of those. And you could say, I'm not working for a company unless they give me paid vacation. Or you could say, that's great. Pay me the salary. I don't need the time off. I mean, you get to make the choice as an employee. You're not forced into it.
In my industry, that's the standard. Either you have that or you are not employed, or you have your own business. So, I mean, that's the beauty of what this will hopefully take away, is all of, especially the big companies, just having the monopoly on it and saying, okay, you either do this or you don't work.
Except for this, the marketplace should supply this. When somebody says, hey, we could get all these great employees who would rather work without a no-compete, and we can put our hands on all those employees because they don't want to work under these agreements, and we'll scoop up all this talent that the other companies aren't going to get because they insist on a no-compete. Why wouldn't that happen if there are a majority or even a sizable number of people like you who say, I don't want to work under that kind of arrangement?
The biggest problem is there aren't those companies.
We'll start one.
I'm unemployed, okay?
Well, that's, yeah, hey, isn't okay. That the best time to start a company when you're unemployed? You know, because, yeah, if you're employed, you say, I don't want to give up my paycheck, so I'm not gonna start a company now. Start a company now. But, Kevin, the reason I've said I've worked under no-competes for a long time, and yes, they're a limitation. In the same way, in some ways, do you own a house or do you rent your home?
No, I own a home. So.
Okay. Now, when you rented an apartment, did you have a lease?
Yes.
And the lease was a limitation on both of you. It said to the landlord, you can't kick Kevin out as long as he pays the rent. Even if rents go up, you got to pay. You know, he gets paid the same amount of money for whatever period you've chosen, 12 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is. There's a limitation on you. You can't just walk in and say, I'm moving out next month until your lease is up. And there's a limitation on the landlord. Isn't that the same kind of arrangement where an employer says, I'll put you on the payroll, but if one day you tell me I don't want to work for you anymore, and I'm going to take everything I know about the business, and I'm going to take it across town or across the street and sell it to your competitor for a lot of money?
Well, see, that's where I think the person leaving, I could see them having some sort of limitation when you leave. But if the employer suddenly decides, we're going to just totally eliminate your division, then that, you know, that's not anything that you did with the way you worked, because, you know, I was very successful at what I did, and I have no problem getting a job once my non-compete is up.
Did you try to negotiate that?
The non-compete?
Yeah, well, in this sense, if you said, I'm willing to agree to a no-compete, as long as I'm making the decision to leave. But if you decide to lay me off, I want the no-compete either to not be there at all or to be much shorter. Because you're allowed to negotiate that now, but now Joe Biden's going to take that away from you and say you can't any longer negotiate. There can't be any no-compete at all.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm in favor of it because they weren't willing to negotiate. There's no negotiation for the most part in that. And, I mean, you and your business should know that that's something that's not even negotiable. Of course, now with
it
you...
It is. Oh, but you're wrong about Kevin. I have negotiated them. You can negotiate the length. Say, I'm willing to... If you lay me off, the no-compete has to be done in 30 days. Or it's 6 months. Or it's 2 years. Or whatever it is. Everything is negotiable, Kevin. Right?
Except I'm not Lars Larson.
Well, I got to tell you something. Yeah. I'm glad for the success I've had, but I've been negotiating no competes for, I don't know, 30 years, and I wasn't. Well, I was still Lars Larson back then, but I've built some success. And so even when you don't, if they want you badly enough, I mean, if you go to an employer and say, hey, I want to take that job, but I need 3 weeks off for a vacation my wife and I have already planned with the kids. If your employer says no, you say, fine, I'll go to work for somebody else. I mean, and every employer knows that's your ability to choose, too. Kevin, great naysayer call, and I appreciate it.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Are you ready?
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Happy Friday.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
You're a lying dog-faced pony soldier.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Crank that speaker.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to talk for a moment about something that's going on involving all these people crossing the border. But this is about how the money that's being spent is absolutely causing non-governmental organizations, known in the trade as NGOs, to absolutely explode their budgets. I don't mean they're in bad shape. I mean they're in fantastic shape. Because they're able to get a whole bunch of money, not just private contributions, but government monies as well. And when they get that amount of money, they sometimes spend it on the most foolish things. But let me get into the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. And if you want to jump into what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we will put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can cast a vote in our poll on X. The question today on what used to be Twitter, should cities provide free beer and vodka to homeless alcoholics? My answer is no. And if you're wondering, Lars, there isn't a city in America crazy enough to do that. Well, San Francisco is that crazy. Their Department of Public Health has what they call the Managed Alcohol Program that provides free beer and shots of vodka to homeless alcoholics at taxpayer expense because they say this is part of keeping these people safe. Gee, if I only had known that about my alcoholic dad, you mean I could keep my dad safe even though he's an alcoholic by just giving enough beer and vodka to him? Who knew? In any case, I would say no to that. I want to hear the naysayers on that as well. You can find the poll on X at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and always brought to you by AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens. AMAC has the conservative values I believe in. I join, you should too. Just go to amac.us or call 888-262-2006. AMAC's better. Better for you and better for America. Now on Friday, First Amendment Friday, I ask you, should Joe Biden be impeached for demanding the quid pro quo of Israel? You either back off from Hamas or you don't get the weapons to fight against the Hamas terrorists. I thought that's the kind of quid pro quo that Democrats before have said that's inappropriate for a president to tell one of our allies you can't have the armament to fight the biggest threat to your existence unless you agree not to go after the Hamas terrorists. 91% of you agreed with me and said yes. Only 9% of you said no. To your calls first, let's go to Sean in Nevada. Hey, Sean, thanks for listening on KKFT. What's on your mind?
How's it going, Lars? First long-time listener, first-time caller. I just want to call and talk about the Lady Joy from Washington kind of hit home with me.
From California. And just make sure you know where she's coming from. She's from California.
No, I apologize.
Which kind of figures. No worries.
I think she was completely wrong. I'm 38 years old. I've worked the trade since my early 20s. Mm-hmm. I bought my first house when I was 25.
Congrats.
My wife was able to stay home and raise both of our kids till my oldest boy was about 10. We had to put him in school because inflation, so the wife now gone back to work. But I do agree,
thank you, Joe
early
Biden.
Education. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, he created a job. Good for him. job that didn't need to be done because I used to make $50,000 a year and served us fine. And with the old early education stuff that she was saying, I think that's a little ridiculous too. Because, like, yeah, I do agree early education is important. But, like I said, we were homeschooling. And my 10-year-old, when he went into school for his first time, skipped a grade. So early education's good. But when you put him in a class with a bunch of kids that didn't have the early education, and now they're pretty much in a class with a bunch of kids that are behind them, so eventually they just end up in the same spot.
Yeah, and all I tell you, Sean, is if it did some good, I'd be in favor of it. The problem is, and not just me, but the academic studies where they've had people at universities look at this and say, can we tell the difference in how a kid is doing, you know, if they've been in early education or not? And the answer is no. After you see a little difference in first grade and kindergarten, and then it starts to fade sharply in second grade, and by third grade, all the academic studies I've seen show no difference at all. So if you say, but if it doesn't make any difference long term and the kids still get to where they're going to get to education-wise, why do it? And because the monies, I haven't checked to see what Nevada spends on early education, but I'm willing to bet it's in the billions of dollars. And to spend billions of dollars when it doesn't do any good, I mean, if I told you, I mean, there are lots of things that you might say, well, that sounds like a good idea, and maybe it'll help. But if you can't show that it actually makes a difference and it costs a lot of money, then why do it?
See, that kind of goes to what I was speaking of, to where, like, you know, my kid was homeschooled. My oldest boy was homeschooled his entire life. You know, he had that early education. And when he went into public schools, he skipped a grade. Because if I would have put him in fourth grade, he would have been with a bunch of kids that were behind him. And in 3 years' time, he'd be in the same spot as the rest of those kids.
So you let everybody learn at their own rate. And Sean, think about that in terms of anything we do. I used to ski, snow ski, and I was never more than a moderate snow skier. But if you threw me in an advanced class, I'd be totally lost. Throw me in a beginner class, I can already ski better than that. So it does me no good either way. You got to fit education to the kid. And unfortunately, this takes me back to the beginning of the pandemic when people said, where do you think we're going to find the solution to this? This was in winter and spring of 2020. And I said, it's not going to come from the government, because the government tends to look at everything and say, it's a one size fits all problem. We'll have the same solution for everyone, whether they're in a small town or a big city, whether you're old, whether you're young, one size fits all. And that never fits people, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, it goes to what you were speaking about skiing. I mean, if you had all those advanced students go to a beginner class, they're not advancing more their knowledge. So if you had early education, and you bring them into the class with everybody else that did not, and they're going to learn at the same rate as all the kids that did not, that advanced early education was pointless. Because
everything they learned,
it just got wasted.
I just think
no good at all.
And the problem is, though, you can see the two parties that really love early education. One is parents, because they say, guess what? Instead of having to pay a babysitter or daycare, we're going to take the kid off your hands at age 3 or 4 and have them till they start kindergarten. And you say, okay, that's great. That's a load off. Okay. I understand why parents would like that. And for the teachers' unions, they get to represent all the people who are going to be the teachers in this early education. They'll get to set the salaries, collect some more union dues. The unions love it, and some parents love it. And for the rest of it, it's very expensive daycare. Sean, thanks for the call. Back in just a moment, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Honestly, provocative talk for America.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Elon Musk sums up America's government.
And what I see all over the place is people who care about looking good while doing evil.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday, live in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and hopefully supplying honestly provocative talk radio. You want to be provocative? Tell everybody in Washington State that because of the actions largely of Democrats, it might even be 100% Democrats in Olympia, that your heating costs are going to go up. And they're not going to go up a little bit. They're going to go up a lot, because the state of Washington has been placed on a glide path to go out and eliminate natural gas. And if you say, but I have a natural gas furnace and a natural gas water heater and a natural gas stove or oven or both or all three, and you say, well, guess what? Your bill's going to go up, and you're going to have to pay for brand new appliances, brand new furnace, brand new water heater, and you're going to pay those electric rates that are going to cost you a lot more money to heat your house, to heat your water, to cook your food. And nobody knows that better than Senator Chris Gildon, who's a Republican representing Puyallup, basically Washington's 25th district. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So the Democrats got what they wanted, didn't they?
Well, you know, they passed this bill out of the House at 2 in the morning, which is usually whenever they pass the bad bills. It passed by the narrowest of margins with only 50 votes, which is the bare minimum needed to pass a bill. And I hear that that was done with a lot of strong arm tactics on a couple of Democrats who were not necessarily sold on the bill. There was a lot of pressure on the governor to veto portions of the bill. In the end, he did not, and he signed the bill into law as it passed the legislature.
And by the way, this just gets the process started by telling what Puget Sound Energy, among others, that you can start moving away from providing natural gas, kind of a soft ban where PSE can say to homeowners or people who are building homes, yeah, we're not going to provide natural gas for that. And even telling some of their customers, in a few years, we no longer have an obligation to provide you with natural gas. We do it because we choose to. And if later on we decide, now we don't want to be on natural gas because the state regulators are all over us, that they are free to abandon gas service to citizens?
Yeah, so what the bill does is it allows Puget Sound Energy to present plans to phase out natural gas to the Utilities and Transportation Committee, and they have to do that by 2027. Now, one thing of note here is that every member of the Utilities and Transportation Committee is appointed by the governor. So I think it's kind of, you can't say that it's an outright ban, but what you can say is it's kind of a predetermined scheme, I would say.
And but once it sets that motion, if PSE presents this plan, and as you said, they're going to be under pressure, get rid of natural gas because greenies view this as just about as evil as coal or oil or anything else, that when PSE goes to its customers, are they going to get much warning? By the way, we're going to stop providing natural gas service and you need to switch over to electric sometime soon. I mean, are citizens even given the assurance we'll have at least 10 years or 20 years or 30 years to make the transition, or should we anticipate something else?
No, it's interesting you mention that, because whenever we were debating the bill on the Senate floor, we offered about 25 different amendments, and one of those amendments specifically said that Puget Sound Energy must give 8 years notice so that people can start preparing for that transition. They can start getting the electric infrastructure wired into their house so they have sufficient capacity. They can replace that gas stove with an electric stove, the gas heater with a heat pump. And that amendment was voted down by the Senate Democrats.
Okay, so the reality is somebody who's told you have 8 years, I'm told the cost of conversion is between $40,000 and $70,000. So you go to tell a citizen, you live in a $400,000 house, you're not right in the Seattle metro, $400,000 house, we need you to spend $70,000 to change your house over from gas to electric. You got 8 years to do it. So this person may be paying as much as $10,000 a year to be able to make that switch over.
Yeah, but the thing is, Lars, is that amendment did not hang. That amendment was rejected.
Yeah, that's if they got 8 years. So it could be a lot shorter.
There's no notice. There's no notice requirement in the bill as it stands right now.
I mean, with no notice at all, that means they could just walk up and say, hey, by the way, Jan 1, your nat gas service stops, better get ready. And PSE could legally do that right now.
Well, they'll have to go through the process of submitting their plan to the Utilities and Transportation Committee. Then they'll have to have hearings on it. So there's a little bit of a process. But as soon as the Utilities and Transportation Commission approves the plan, they can begin implementing it.
Now, is there any chance to kill this thing, or are we just going to have to throw it to the ballot and then put it to the voters?
Well, it's interesting you mention that, Lars, because one of the parts of the bill contains an emergency clause. That means that the bill becomes effective as soon as the governor signs it, and it is not subject to a referendum by the citizens. That means that typically if there's a bill that the citizens don't like, they have a certain time period after the bill passes. They can go out and collect signatures and put it on the ballot that next November. Because this has an emergency clause on it, you are not allowed to do that with this bill, Lars.
So this now comes down to PSE, which owes its entire existence to state regulators. Am I right? If I stated that way, is that overstating it, that PSE knows state regulators could put them out of business fairly quickly?
Well, kind of, but it would be the state regulators would be adjudicating the plan that Puget Sound Energy puts forth.
Senator, one fine tuning to that. Doesn't PSE have to go to these state regulators for every single rate increase they want? So if the state regulators want to put pressure on you, you say, you know what, PSE, the next time you come in and show us that your actual costs have gone up 10%, we might only give you 7. So you're going to be eating 3% of it. And they know that, don't they?
That's correct.
And that doesn't deal directly with the plan. It just says PSE knows if they choose to, they can start denying us rate increases. They can start denying us other things. And the end result of that could be, I'm not suggesting the company go out of business, but they'll buckle under that kind of pressure, won't they?
Yeah, and the thing about it is they're the only ones that are providing service in the area. So there's really no one else to fall back on.
And this is really, this is the Democrats, and it was all Democrats. Was there a single Republican that voted for this?
There was not a single Republican that voted for this.
Okay, because they've changed the relationship of utility, and tell me if I'm wrong, citizens to utilities is, if a utility company says we want to provide electric service or gas service, when they agree to do it within a territory, they must provide that service to the citizens, correct?
They have to provide it.
And now they don't.
If whatever plan Puget Sound Energy puts forward, they would not have to, correct.
Wow. Senator Chris Gildon, who represents the Puyallup area, that's Washington's 25th district. Senator, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. I'm not afraid of social media. Check us out on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and all the other social media, and tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Lars Larson Show. Truth be told, Lars has welcomed naysayers for 27 years, but occasionally...
Who is this person who speaks to me as though I needed his advice?
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So where do we draw the line between genuine science inquiry and pseudoscience or science creep? And is it ruining science? I thought we'd talk to our friend Dr. Henry Miller from the American Council on Science and Health. He is a medical doctor, molecular biologist, and he's also the Glenn Swagger Distinguished Fellow at ACSH. Also founding director of the FDA's Office of Biotechnology. Would you mind describing for my audience what you mean by science creep?
Yeah. The
The term and the subject was suggested to me when Holden Thorpe, who's the editor-in-chief of the journal Science, very prestigious journal, wrote an article about essentially who is a scientist. And he posed that question to a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the answers ranged from the participants, ranged from very narrow, just people who are doing or planning research, all the way to very broad, essentially every living human being who has an opinion about a scientific subject. And my gripe with the article was that he didn't circumscribe who should be omitted from that definition. And everybody who has an opinion, everybody who posts on Twitter or X and says, I did my own research, and I think everybody who is vaccinated with any vaccine and then who suddenly dies has had an adverse reaction to the vaccine, that's not science. That's just wild opinion based on no actual data. So there were two interesting comments on the article by Thorpe. The first said was from the certain well-known surgeon and writer Atul Gawande. He said, "Science is not a major or a career. It's a commitment to a systematic way of thinking, an allegiance to a way of building knowledge and explaining the universe through testing and factual observation." And that's my definition. I agree with that completely. The second comment was, "A scientist is someone who follows the scientific method, period. Unfortunately, we've reached a point in our culture where almost no one knows what the scientific method is anymore." So I agree with that one, too. And one of my colleagues at ACSH had a good comment about Thorpe's article. He said, this is sort of an erudite version of every kid gets a trophy. Everybody gets respect for his opinion, no matter how ill-conceived, no matter how poorly constructed. So that's the reason for this. But there's also a backstory that's I can tell you about very briefly.
Well, tell me, please, because I got a couple of questions.
Okay. The American Association for the Advancement of Science, which publishes Science Magazine and does other things, recently gave a major award prize that's given to the author or authors of the most outstanding paper in science in the previous year. So what would you think that might be, Lars? Maybe a major breakthrough in cold fusion, so we have cheap, dependable energy.
Which is another example of bad science, right? But, yeah.
Well, or maybe gene editing as a cure for sickle cell anemia, or artificial intelligence for some medical application. No, it went to a group that found that horses were introduced into the Great Plains and Northern Rockies earlier than had previously been thought.
That was the big development?
That was supposedly the most outstanding paper in science for the previous year. Now, why do you think that was chosen? Well, I can make a good guess. It was a group of indigenous scientists who authored that paper.
Oh, politics got into it, didn't it?
Exactly. And this is the kind of rubbish, the kind of muddled thinking that we have in the science establishment these days. Now, I'll shut up and let you ask.
Well, I'm just worried about this because, for instance, at most American major universities, there are lots of grant dollars to be spent to prove or to aid in proving that global warming is what all the global warming alarmists say it is. There is no money out there to say to the contrary. And what I worry about is when you have a system that has decided that some things are acceptable and other things are heresy, and they can find, then they can do to you what they did to Galileo. You know, put him on his knees and say, you are guilty of heresy. You are contradicting because the system is not just a system of weights and measures and how that part of science is done. The system is, you wrote a paper that suggests that global warming is not caused by man, that it's not caused by CO2, it's caused, say, by water vapor, which is what causes most global warming, not CO2, but water vapor. Well, that's heresy. Your science is not allowed. And I worry that when the scientific establishment has lots of dollars tied to it, and the dollars say what you're allowed to call science and what's not allowed to be called science.
Oh, there's no question that's going on. So a good example of that, using your climate warming example, is that there's tremendous amounts of U.S. resources being spent on reducing CO2 emissions. And that's just not going to work. We are never going to get there with solar panels and wind farms and that sort of thing. If we want to do that, if science has decided, that leaving it open, that warming is a function of greenhouse gas emissions, it's got to be nuclear. And as you know, I recently did a paper with a colleague suggesting that we reduce the amount of sun that gets to the Earth with balloons, large balloons, to reflect a lot of the sun's rays. So, you can't do it with electric vehicles and with this sort of nonsense that is being attempted with trillions and trillions of dollars.
If you commit the heresy of denying that, you'll find yourself defunded and usually kicked to the curb by the rest of the scientific establishment that is tied into all that money that flows from it. And money really does make a difference here, doesn't it?
Absolutely. There's so much self-interest and ideological commitment tied into certain things, as you point out, that it's very hard to resist it. And, you know, and consequently, we have people believing the likes of John Kerry and Greta Thunberg, of all people.
Oh my God!
Dictating national and international policies.
Well, the other thing, and we'll have to be quick because I'm up against the break, but if you've ever seen the movie The Dig, which was about one of the most consequential archaeological discoveries of all time, you know, in Great Britain, it was Sutton Hoo, and they discovered something that changed the entire view of human history in Great Britain for hundreds of years, and it was made by a guy who didn't have a university degree. And much of the establishment tried to kick him to the curb, say, you don't have a degree in front of your name. We don't call you doctor or professor. Therefore, we can't trust anything you do. And yet it turns out that his work was very, very good and very consequential. Dr. Henry Miller from the American Council on Science and Health. I'll get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. 866-439-5277. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to The Best of The Lars Larson Show. Sometimes the listeners say it best.
Hey, Lars, love your show, and I really appreciate what you do. Boy, you cover more territory in an afternoon than a lonely dad in springtime.
Who's next? This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. The poll on X we have for today. Do we really need to take all the male pronouns out of state constitutions? It's being proposed in Washington State by, of course, a Democrat, Bill Ramos, who's a Democrat representative from Issaquah. He says we want to take out the 100 male pronouns in the Washington State Constitution. I looked up the Constitution and went back through it this morning. Turns out Section 1 says who is liable to military duty. If you take the male pronoun out and replace it with a generic or an all-encompassing neutral term, they're going to declare all women in the state of Washington are liable to military duty. And I wonder how they're going to work around that. Today's poll on X can be found at Lars Larson Show on X. It can also be found on our website at LarsLarson.com and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. To your calls now. Let's start with Brandon. Hey, Brandon, sorry about the unfortunate name, but that's okay. Welcome to the program, and what's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I just wanted to mention, one, I work at a hotel, and we get a lot of people sent over to Oregon. I get homeless people with stacks of cash coming from Montana or just the craziest places, the East Coast. Getting a lot of immigrants, too, and they also have stacks of cash, and it's really confusing how these people have stacks of cash.
Well, Joe Biden, as I understand it, when many of the illegals are coming across, the federal government and private groups, nonprofits that are often funded by our taxpayer dollars, like the UN, NGOs run by the UN, are saying these people have to have some money in their hands so they can, you know, meet the basic necessities of life. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying this is what they're doing. They take our money. If it comes from the UN to NGOs and then to the illegal, it's our tax money. If it comes from the Biden administration through the CBP or ICE and then to the illegals, it's our money. You know, that may be one explanation.
Yeah, it's really sad when our vets don't get anything. And it almost makes me wonder if this is to cripple America.
I think so. I mean, that and provide a voter base for Democrats. Because, Brandon, I made the point that earlier this week we found out Arizona is now telling illegal aliens you have to show proof of citizenship if you want to vote. But if you don't have proof of citizenship, we will still sign you up to vote, and you can vote in federal elections, meaning the presidential election, among other things.
That's very concerning. It's just a strange world we live in now. Very strange.
Yeah, it very much is. Brandon, thanks so much for the call. 866-439-5277. Let me go to Michelle. Hey, Michelle, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I was happily going through the radio, and I picked up your show. I don't normally listen, but I know of you.
Thank you.
You were just talking to the gentleman about the superintendent about transgenders in schools.
Yep.
And there are two kinds of trans folk. There are the kind that are truly misunderstanding who they are when they're growing up. Mm-hmm. And then there are the kinds that it's a fetish. Okay. That's basically the two categories. I am a trans woman. I have been for 12 years now, as far as I, you know, went through the process. People, when they talk about abuse and things like that, I can tell you this, it's abusive to make someone not be who they are. I was terrified as a kid to be who I was. I remember when I was
still
young.
Right? It was abuse. You were male, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. All right.
And even as a kid, pre-10 years old, I looked out wishing that if I could ever have one wish, it was to be a woman. At 10, I knew. And I sat terrified and in closet most of my adult life until I finally couldn't take it anymore. The reason you're seeing a surge of this is because it's become more accepted. That's the main reason. It has nothing to do with the woke society or whatever.
Does that explain the gigantic surge that we've seen in people claiming to be trans?
Yes, because it's now you're not going to get bullied or beat up or harmed in some way. You're allowed to actually be who you are.
Well, what do you think of the idea? My idea would be if you're an adult and you want to go out and do things to your body, that's your business. Don't make me pay for it through taxes like Medicare and other services. But if you're an adult, do whatever crazy thing you want. I mean, I often wonder why an awful lot of younger people who appear to be attractive young men and women, this is not a trans issue, they'll have all kinds of piercings in their face. And I think you had a nice looking face before you put all these piercings through it. But why? It's not my business. You want to mutilate your body, go ahead. But mutilating children, could we agree, should be absolutely off limits chemically or surgically?
Well, the problem is that if you are like me, and you should be something else. There's actually physical, medical reasoning for us to be. Okay, sorry. No, I don't think it's mutilation for trans to be who they are.
So if we take a 14-year-old girl or a 14-year-old boy and chemically castrate him, that's okay.
If that's their identity, yeah.
At 14, they're going to make that kind of life-changing decision. Michelle, I can't agree with you on that. You got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.